From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, he came to Michigan from Nigeria in 1983. He's deaf, can't speak, and has cognitive disabilities. Now ICE says Francis Anwana must be deported.
He would know not a soul. He could not speak or communicate to anyone. He has some developmental issues. This would be a death sentence.
Members resigning from the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce over its endorsement of Bill Schuette for governor.
And really, I didn't feel the chamber should be endorsing any candidate.
He grew up in Metro Detroit, but now Bob Anderson croons his way around the country as a Frank Sinatra impressionist.
I have never heard anybody ever come up to me and say they didn't like Frank Sinatra's music. Never.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Supporters of Francis Anwana will rally today outside the Detroit offices of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Anwana is a 48-year-old man who came to Michigan from Nigeria in 1983 to go to school. He's deaf. He can't speak. He has cognitive disabilities. And ICE says he's here illegally and he must leave. Francis has a meeting with ICE tomorrow. Let's learn more about Francis Anwana and the efforts to stop his deportation. Tanya Morris-Diaz is here with us, an attorney with the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center. And also with us, Diane Newman, a friend and advocate of Francis. Diane, you taught young Francis at the Lutheran School for the Deaf when he first arrived?
Yes, he came in 1983, and I was his first teacher. Francis came to the school with his father that first day. The original plan was for 2 years. They were hoping that he would learn to lip read and speak, but obviously children born profoundly deaf typically show delayed development of literacy and have difficulty acquiring those kinds of spoken language and lip reading skills. Mm. So when Francis came, he acquired sign language very quickly. It offered him a form of expression and communication that he never had with his family back in Nigeria. It opened up a whole new world for him, socially, emotionally, and academically. He was able to make friends with other deaf people and express himself to them and socialize and goof around like any other teenage boy. He was very, very happy at Lutheran School for the Deaf. Many of the students lived right in the school in a residential setting. And most of them on holidays or sometimes long weekends would go home. So staff, myself included, volunteered to take Francis home so he had somewhere to go for the holidays during the school year while he was still there.
And is that why you've developed this
yes.
You know, you're a friend, you're an advocate. He clearly became important to you.
Yes, he, like I said, I remember the first Christmas he came home with us, within a couple of days was kind of sad. And what I figured out was, okay, this is 4 months into his schooling, so he was just learning the concept of a calendar, but he loved, you know, the residential school, so I had to explain to him, oh, we're just home for 2 weeks. He'd never experienced a Christmas holiday. I said, we're home for 2 weeks, and you're going to stay with me, and then on this date, you know, January, we're going to go back to school like we were. Mm-hmm. And then he was fine. So there were so many firsts that first year, but yes, he and I, as well as my family, developed a close relationship, and we did take him home, you know, as other students that were from out of state, I would take home and we'd go to movies or whatever, just so they had something to do like the other students were doing.
And Tanya, ICE says Francis violated the terms of his admission by staying here after leaving school. So how and why did he slip through the cracks?
Right. So in terms of violating his immigration status, that's basically saying that he overstayed mm-hmm. his student visa. In terms of
which is true.
Right. That is true. Really, because of Francis's condition, like I said, he didn't understand the concept of an immigration status or the concept of renewing a student visa or the concept of even overstaying a student visa. And so it fell on him to basically be in charge of his own legal immigration matters.
Now, he came with his father. Was his father then out of the picture?
Well, his father came basically to drop him off, mm. to see him off, but his family never relocated here. He was really here on his own.
His parents did keep in touch with him.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they did, as yeah. much as they could. But in terms of slipping through the cracks, really just, as one can imagine, someone like Francis, it's just understandable that this was something that he didn't understand that he needed to do. This wasn't something that, even if he did understand, he didn't know what he should have done. And so through the help of caregivers and advocates, when they realized that something needed to be done, they did what they could. But because of our immigration system, there were no options for him.
Dan, where does he live now? What does Francis do? And has he ever gotten into legal trouble, any criminal record?
Currently, he's living in Detroit. He moved around after he went to Lutheran School for the Deaf. He went to Michigan School for the Deaf. And then he moved around to various group homes in the Detroit area. And then they moved him to Holly, Michigan. Then he went to Flint. And then recently now he's been relocated to a group home in Detroit. No, he does not have any skirmishes with the law or criminal records at all.
And so here he has been here some 3 dozen years, mm-hmm. the better part of 3 dozen years. When and how did ICE get to him to say, you've got to leave?
So this all began, I believe, back in 2006, when some of his advocates and caregivers attempted to apply for his citizenship. Because he didn't have legal permanent residency, a green card, most commonly known, there was no path to citizenship for him. And so by applying for citizenship with USCIS, USCIS referred that information over to ICE, which began the deportation proceedings of Francis.
So I guess I've got to wonder, and perhaps, Diane, you have the best sense of this, who would be there in Nigeria? What would happen to Francis if he were to be deported to Nigeria?
His mother is still there. There have been some communications through the years with her. He does have a brother in New York, a stepbrother that he never knew. When this happened, I reached out to that brother, and the latest on the mom, she is ill and lives in a fairly remote village in Nigeria, and the brother was adamant, knowing the area, that Francis would not survive if he goes back there. And when Francis came here, I think he, again, as I explained earlier, just flourished, and this became his home. As far as going back, I don't know that anyone would be there for him. I do know that he would not be able to function on his own. He would not be able to communicate his needs because no one there would be able to communicate with him. And I think it would be his demise. I don't think he would survive. He will say when you ask him, do you remember Nigeria? I think he's just wiped that all out. He will say no. He said, I want to stay here. I want to stay in America. I don't want to go back to Nigeria.
Right. I wanted to add that when Francis is asked about Nigeria, his memories of Nigeria, or anything about Nigeria, he says he simply doesn't remember. So to him, Nigeria, even though he was born there, Nigeria is a foreign country to him.
Right.
And Congressman
Absolutely.
Dan Kildee has gotten involved with this. What do you want to tell us about that?
Right. So Dan Kildee has introduced a private bill to allow Francis to become a legal permanent resident and therefore providing him pathway to citizenship.
What's the timetable? Because there's this meeting with ICE tomorrow
right.
morning. Mm-hmm. What's the timetable, your best guess, on this bill?
On this bill? Well, because it's a private immigration bill, really, that is a matter separate from what's happening with ICE. Usually ICE should respect the fact and give time to allow breathing room for this bill to pass.
You say usually.
Well, we're living in an era where usuallys just don't seem to matter. We're operating under a completely different framework with this administration. So it's really hard to guess how ICE will react to that. In the past, usually ICE has respected private immigration bills and given time for it to pass. But that's not to say that there aren't other avenues that we're seeking to help Francis. That's just one. Over at Merck, we're looking at every sort of possible way that we can help Francis. This bill is just one of them, but it's certainly not the only one.
What are some of the other options?
I don't want to get too much into the details, but ICE is basically saying that they're allowing him time to leave voluntarily. We really just need to communicate with ICE how returning to Nigeria really would be detrimental to Francis. So we're communicating with ICE. We're doing everything we can in our legal toolbox to assure that Francis can stay here. So speaking with ICE, speaking with the government, and also this private bill.
Tanya Morris-Diaz, an attorney with the Michigan Immigrant Rights Center, and Diane Newman, a longtime friend and advocate for Francis and Juana. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We turn now to Flint's Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee. He has introduced a bill to give Francis Anwana a green card to protect him from deportation. We caught up with him during a campaign event in Ann Arbor to learn more.
These private bills, private immigration bills, are pretty rare, and I have not had a situation yet that I thought warranted it. But Francis, his situation is clearly one that just begs for a solution. There would be no justice, there would be no good achieved by deporting him to a country that he doesn't know, that he doesn't understand, where he doesn't know anybody, and where he couldn't communicate. And so I filed a bill that would grant him permanent resident status. They're hard to pass. It will take a big lift. It's going to take a lot of voices to get other members of Congress to be willing to go along with this, particularly in the Republican majority. Mm-hmm. But I saw no alternative.
And I know he has a meeting Friday morning with ICE. How does that sync up with the progress of your bill?
Well, the hope is that ICE will recognize that this bill is being considered, and that even if their own sense of justice doesn't motivate them to stop any deportation proceeding, that maybe the expectation that this bill may succeed would keep them from moving forward. So we're hoping that it buys us some time to give us a chance to move this legislation forward.
We reached out to ICE's Detroit office for a comment on the Anwana case, and they sent us the following statement, and I quote, "Anwana, a citizen of Nigeria illegally residing in the U.S., was admitted to the United States in 1987 as an F-1 non-immigrant student, but violated the terms of his admission by remaining in the U.S. when he was no longer enrolled in school, which made him subject to removal. In an exercise of discretion, ICE is allowing Mr. Anwana to make arrangements to depart the U.S. voluntarily." Coming up, the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce has endorsed GOP candidate for Governor Bill Schuette. We'll hear from one of the many business people asking the chamber to rescind that endorsement. Stay with us.
From across the sea, it lingered there to touch your hair and walk with me.
Yes, that is one of Frank Sinatra's greatest hits. But if you think that's Old Blue Eyes you're hearing, think again. That's Sinatra as channeled by Bob Anderson, who's been a fixture in Vegas and on stages all around the country with his show Frank, the Man, the Music. But long before he became the embodiment of Sinatra, Bob Anderson grew up in Warren and graduated from Centerline High. Bob Anderson, welcome.
Cynthia, thank you so much for having me. This is great.
So tell me, what was some of the music you were listening to back in the old Centerline High days? Who'd you like growing up?
You know what? I liked everybody. I mean, living in Detroit, as you know, Motown, how do you not like Marvin Gaye and mm-hmm. Smokey Robinson and Martha Reeves and the Temptations, everybody?
Yeah.
And I loved all that. I loved Elvis Presley. I loved Tom Jones. I loved Michael Jackson. But the main thing for me, I got hooked on the singers of the Great American Songbook. Mm. You know, Tony Bennett, Nat King Cole, Andy Williams, Johnny Mathis, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Bobby Darin. All those guys.
What got you hooked on that? Was it the songs?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It was the songs, but I really appreciated how well they were performed. I want my kids to always think that their music is the greatest music that ever happened at any time. I want them to feel that way about it in their generation. But you and I actually know the truth about all that.
Wink, wink.
The greatest music this world has ever known came from the, like, say, the 60s through the 80s, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s.
Even 40s, some of those
in the 40s,
great
right.
songs, sure.
Well, what they did, though, because it was the best of everything they gave you. They had all the great composers like the Gershwins and Cole Porter and Rodgers and Hart. And they would take the wonderful songs from the Broadway stages, and they would do those. And not only that, they had the greatest arrangers, Nelson Riddle, Don Costa, Gordon Jenkins, Billy May, mm-hmm. all these people that arranged this stuff, Johnny Mandel, and then the singers. I became friends with all of the singers that I grew up listening to. It was really crazy. I caught the tail end of the golden age of the Strip.
How did you get from Warren, and I know you sang around Detroit for some time, how did get to Vegas and wind up being friends with all these legendary names?
Well, I'll tell you. I came back from Vietnam. I was in the 4th Infantry Division. I was only 20 years old when I got back, and I wanted to clear my head. You know, I had long hair, long curly hair, cut off sandals, a peace sign for a belt buckle. I even had a Volkswagen Beetle. So anyway, I got my Volkswagen and I drove out west. I was going to Los Angeles. I didn't know Route 66 took me to Las Vegas, out of Chicago. I wound up in Vegas. I slept in my car for 3 days, didn't have any money for a hotel and stuff. So I pulled my car in my old Volkswagen and parked way in the back of the hotel. Mm-hmm. So I walked into the hotel, and I see the Conga showroom. Well, I open up the door, and a dude was there. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He says, yeah, can I help you, kid? And I said, no, man, I'm just looking around, buddy. So I walk away, and he says, hey, kid, come here. He said, you ever see a rehearsal? I said, no, I don't even know what it is. He said, well, they're practicing it here. Come on in. You want to see it? He said, it's Nancy Sinatra up here with the Everly Brothers. You can watch them. So I said, yeah, I'll sit down. I sat down, and in 2 minutes, they had a big argument. They got in a big fight, the Everly Brothers on the stage. They walked off. They had been rehearsing for 5 days, and they left the show. Nancy was caught, and she was going to open in 4 hours. And her whole act had to be changed. Everybody was in a panic. And I go, and I tell the guy, hey, I said, I'm a singer, man. And he laughed, and he said, you're a singer? I said, yeah. I said, I can do whatever she needs. He said, well, go tell her. So I did. I walked up to the stage and I said, they were looking like, how did he get in here? And I said, excuse me. I said, Nancy. I said, hey, I'm a singer and I can do anything you need. And so I opened that evening in the Sahara Hotel with her, and I stayed with her touring. I took the Everly Brothers spot. And she brought me on the Merv Griffin show.
Yeah.
And I just sang a song. I was never doing any impressions.
You were just singing as you. Yeah.
As me. Never an impressionist. But I grew up listening to all those singers. I would babysit for my brothers. I was the youngest one in the family. And I would put the speakers by my ears and just listen to Sinatra. I just fell in love with it. And Johnny Mathis and Tony Bennett and Andy Williams, all these guys. And I would sing along to their records. And I tried to sing as closely as I could to what I was listening to. So I said, if I could sound like them, I'd be really doing great because they're the best. Now, I had no idea that subconsciously I was putting them embedded in my brain.
Sure were.
So years later, this happened. I did the Merv Griffin show. Paul Anka called me as soon as I was on the show with Nancy Sinatra. I get a phone call, and he says, Bob, this is Paul Anka. I said, Paul. He said, I saw you on a Merv Griffin show, and I'm going to bring you back on next week with me. I said, can you do that? He said, I just told you this is Paul Anka. So he did it. I did the show again. Merv Griffin came up to me after the show and said, Bob, we really like you on the show, but we just can't keep having you on here. You've either got to have a hit record, be in the movies, or do something. So I go to a party a year later to Merv Griffin's. I'm working with Joan Rivers at a workshop in Los Angeles. We go to the party. Everybody in Hollywood's there. It's his 50th birthday. I mean, Gregory Peck, Henry Fonda, Jimmy Stewart, everybody's there. Beach Boys. He plays the piano. I get up out of nowhere. I start singing the songs like the people who made them famous.
It just started. The impressions came out.
Yeah, and everybody, you could hear a pin drop in a second because nobody was doing singing impressions. Impressionists used to do actors or political figures.
Frank Gorshin, perfect
the greatest,
example. The greatest.
Great friend of mine, Frank.
Yeah.
And so anyway, Merv said, we found your act. You're going to be the singing impressionist. And he was on the show, and he wrote my whole show for me. He took me back to Caesar's Palace on Friday, and he said, all those great stars are wrapped up in his necks, and you've waited to hear him. He's known as the singing impressionist, so I became an impressionist.
So you now focus on Sinatra. Why did you gravitate and dive down into Sinatra?
He's the only one who transcends every generation. He's as popular today as he ever was. And not only here, that's all over the world.
You're
is
right.
What he is.
And he had a career that spanned decades.
Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with his music. It's all wonderful. What's so funny about it, too, is that the arrangements were given to me from Frank Sinatra's musical director. They're all actually Frank Sinatra's in his hand chart.
What did Frank Sinatra say to Vincent Falcone about those arrangements?
Okay, here's what he did. When he was working with them, periodically after their show, Vince was with him for about 12 years, yeah. Sinatra would say, Vinny, here, take this chart home. Make a copy of it and bring one back. Keep one for yourself. So through the years, he wound up giving him 65 of his original arrangements of the greatest Sinatra collection. He told Vince when they went their separate ways because Frank slowed down. He said, Vinny, there's a reason I gave you that music. I want you to keep it going for generations to hear as long as you can. And when you're done, you find somebody else that will continue with it. So unfortunately, Vince, who was one of my best friends, passed away right after our show closed. He got ill and he was gone. But he said to me, Bob, you have to carry this music on. So now I have the 65, and it's so crazy. Nobody in the world has this.
Yeah.
Because people have takedown charts that try to sound like them, but they have Nelson Riddle on them, and Sinatra's name is on them, and I'm holding his music.
Did you ever meet Frank?
Yes, I worked with him 3 times.
So tell me.
And his daughter, Nancy, started me in the business.
Yeah, Nancy started you. So what did he say to you?
I'm in the lounge just doing my regular act.
Your regular act.
But I'm doing everybody.
The impressions, yeah.
I'm doing Bobby Darin and every one of those people, okay? And Frank saw me do it a number of times. So all of a sudden, it's Saturday night. I'm sitting at the bar in the lounge, and I'm looking at a big mirror, and here comes a little ant pile through the casino. And into the room comes Frank Sinatra, and he walks up to me and he grabs me by his shoulders and he said, you know, I wouldn't have missed this kid. So he goes and sits down in a front seat, front table that he was 3 feet from me because it was so intimate that the back of the piano was hitting my butt. And I was sitting right there and singing. He comes in, then Diana Ross walks in after him, then Dean Martin, okay, then Johnny Mathis and Sarah Vaughan and Steve Wynn and Elaine, they all come in.
You have nerves of steel.
Oh, my goodness. So they were wondering what I was going to do. And I said, let me try to recreate a few singers for you. And, of course, I said, how about Tony Bennett? Is that all right? Can I do Tony? And I went into, you know, for once in my life, I have someone that needs me, you know, and all this stuff. And I sang it. And then I turned around and I did Sammy Davis Jr. You know, what kind of fool am I? And I was doing all this stuff here, Sammy. And then Dean Martin starts talking to me as Sammy. So Dean's got his foot on the stage because it was that close, and I kicked his foot off of there, and I said, "That you ain't in this show, buddy. Get your foot off the stage." So Sinatra laughs, and they're waiting to see, is this guy going to do Frank Sinatra?
In front of Sinatra, in front of his nose.
And I did. I did the song that Sammy Kahn wrote, When Somebody Loves You All the Way, and I did it. He loved it. I came down and sat with him. We went out to dinner after the show. He said to me, he said, you got a hell of an act. And he said, you stick with this one. You got a hell of an act. So that's I kept that one, boy.
Boy, that is something to take. Bob, will you take us out with a song?
I certainly will. Love to, yeah. There's one of Sinatra's big hits. You make me feel so young. You make me think that spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I want to run and play hide and seek. I want to go and bounce the moon just like a toy balloon. 'Cause you and I are just like a couple of tots running around the meadow and picking up all those forget-me-nots. You make me feel so young. You make me think there are songs to be sung, bells to be rung,
wonderful fling to be flung. And even when I'm old and gray.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce has endorsed GOP candidate Bill Schuette in the race for governor, and that is not setting well with some of its members. Over 50 business people have signed a letter calling on the chamber to rescind the Schuette endorsement, reports MIBiz. Other companies are withdrawing from the chamber, including Founders Brewing, 834 Integrated Communications, and Grand Rapids restaurants Donkey Taqueria and The Winchester. And the restaurant's owner, Paul Lee, is here with us now. Paul, why sever ties with the Grand Rapids Chamber?
You know, the Chamber has done some amazing things. They've got some amazing programs. I was involved in one of those programs in 2014 called Leadership Grand Rapids. I've met some amazing people and got to see parts of the city and understand parts of the city, some of the issues affecting people in the city. You know, in one of those areas where people are affected are those in the LGBTQ community. And so our decision came about from one of our employees. One of our employees at Donkey, he had heard that the chamber had endorsed publicly Bill Schuette. And, you know, he brought that to our attention, and it was something that was a little concerning for him. And then because of that, I delved in a little bit further, and I realized he was right. It wasn't the right candidate, and really I didn't feel the chamber should be endorsing any candidate without the say of businesses. And we didn't really get to have a say with that. So
I think what I'm hearing you say is the real concern is that opinion that Attorney General Schuette wrote earlier this summer, basically saying that the Elliot Larson civil rights protections don't extend to LGBTQ people.
That is correct. You know, that's one area where, you know, people are not protected. And then for me, it's like, where does it go from there? If it's the LGBT community, then is it immigration? You know, we hire people that are immigrants. And so it is really kind of protecting everybody. Everybody should have equal rights.
Paul, did you try to talk with any chamber executives about this before you resigned? And if so, what was their explanation? And if not, why not?
I didn't talk to anyone at the chamber other than the phone call to state the reason why we're displeased with their decision and to say that we're going to be rescinding our membership.
Andy Johnston, the chamber's vice president of government and corporate affairs, did not respond to our interview request, but he did tell MIBiz that the endorsement of the attorney general for governor does not run counter to the chamber's efforts to urge the legislature and the next governor to extend civil rights protections to the LGBTQ community. Why can't the chamber do both, urge more protections and endorse the candidate it thinks will be best for Grand Rapids business?
My concern is when you align with a candidate or any one political party, if that group does not get into office, then you're already at a disadvantage. You should be working with whoever's in office, be able to cross party lines and work for what is the best for business. And for me, as a business owner, I think what is best for business is really what aligns with the people that we're trying to attract as in terms of customers and also employ. As you look at who you're trying to attract for employment, you know, you want to align your business beliefs with their own.
So in a sense, this social issue of protections for LGBTQ individuals, I'm hearing you describe this as a business issue as well.
It is, absolutely. We're here to attract talent. You know, we can't do what we do if we don't have talented individuals. And if we as a business aren't able to align our beliefs with their own, then, you know, we're just an outdated form of business.
Paul, what are you giving up by resigning from the chamber?
You know, one of the reasons why we initially signed up with the chamber is they had purchasing power when it came to things like insurance. So we do lose a little bit of that. So when we're looking for insurance renewals, because we're no longer members of the chamber, we don't have those rates. Those are one of the things that we give up. But I think it's worth giving that up and for us as a business paying a little bit more, knowing that we're aligning with what is the socially right thing to do.
And what do you foresee coming out of this protest over the Schuette endorsement, particularly the long-term impact on the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce?
Long term, I think what you'll see happen is businesses will take a look at what is the benefit of the chamber. Does the chamber really need a political action committee? Does the chamber need to be endorsing candidates, or would they be better off just presenting all of the facts for everybody that is running and let the businesses or individuals make their own decision on who they should vote for? And so I think you'll start to see that happen. I think, you know, for a small business, they'll really start to weigh, is the benefit worth the risk? You know, if we're here to attract talented individuals and we want to align with the thinking of the people that we're trying to attract and employ, does it make sense to be members of a chamber?
Restaurant owner Paul Lee, one of the business owners who's resigned from the Grand Rapids Area Chamber of Commerce over its endorsement of GOP candidate Bill Schuette for governor. Paul, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
We received a statement from Attorney General Schuette, and I quote, "Michigan must be a place where we grow our recovering economy and ensure there is no room for discrimination of any kind because all people must be treated with dignity, grace, and respect. We will work together to protect everyone, including employment protections and religious liberties. It's been done elsewhere. It's the 21st century. We can do it here, too." His statement goes on to say, and I'm quoting, "Changes in the law in Utah are one example of the ability to find a way forward. But I would be listening to people at the table to find Michigan's way forward, including the folks at Founders and others." Coming up, the risks and benefits of fracking.
Most American households have saved more than $1,000 each in energy costs because of the shale revolution.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Fracking, as you may know, is the common term for hydraulic fracturing, a method of extracting oil and or gas from shale deposits. Daniel Ramey recently wrote a book about it. It's called The Fracking Debate, The Risks, Benefits, and Uncertainties of the Shale Revolution. He sat down with Stateside's Lester Graham in June.
So one of the things I often hear is that Michigan has been using hydraulic fracturing for many decades. And that's true, but most of that was vertical hydraulic fracturing. The debate over fracking recently began when drillers started using horizontal hydraulic fracturing. Can you explain the difference to us?
Sure. Hydraulic fracturing is a type of well stimulation. It's something that's done to an oil and gas well after it's been drilled. And it's been going on really for decades, starting in the middle of the 20th century in Kansas and Oklahoma and expanding to other parts of the United States over the decades. In Michigan, there has been hydraulic fracturing applied to vertically drilled wells, as you say, for decades. But in the last 10 or 15 years, companies have gotten better at combining hydraulic fracturing with horizontal and directional drilling. So instead of just drilling down into a shale formation or another type of rock, companies drill down and then sideways for 1, 2, maybe even 3 miles into the rock formation, and that allows them to access a larger deposit of oil and gas. It could be more economical to produce.
So exactly what is hydraulic fracturing? I mean, I understand it's hydraulic, so it must include some kind of fluid and pressure, but what happens from there?
So the way hydraulic fracturing works is that at the surface, after a well has been drilled, a variety of trucks and equipment are moved into place, and they mix a fluid together of large volume of water. Typically, water makes up 95 to 98% of the mixture with sand and chemicals. Those chemicals are often very controversial because not all of them are always disclosed. So that's one important point of contention. The purpose of the sand is to, after the water has been pumped into the rock to create fractures in the rock formation, the sand stays behind to keep those fractures open. And oil and gas can flow through those fractures into the wellbore and then up to the surface. The purpose of the chemicals that are mixed in with the fluid are varied. Typically, there are 5, 10, 15 different chemicals that are added to the fluid, and they perform functions such as killing bacteria that might be found deep underground or preventing buildup within the
well. Why
would
they need to kill bacteria?
In some cases, the fresh water that is pumped deep into the well actually has bacteria in it. And so you don't want to be injecting live organisms down into the rock formation because those organisms have the potential to inhibit production from the well itself. And so each of these chemicals play a different role in basically making it easier and preventing problems from occurring downhole.
You explained in your book that this was originally called slick water. There's a lubrication that's involved here. Water would seem to be a lubricant enough in most cases, not here?
Yeah, normally you would think that water is a slippery enough fluid to do the job. But if you imagine spilling a glass of water on your kitchen floor and how slippery that is, and then imagine spilling a glass of motor oil on your kitchen floor and imagining how much more slippery that is, it gives you a sense of how water might actually not be the best lubricant when you're going deep underground at very high pressures and very high temperatures. And so different chemicals are added to increase the ability of these fluids to move underground.
And it's usually viscous, so it kind of suspends the sand particles, right?
That's correct. The, okay. The sand is suspended in the fluid as it's pumped down, and then much of the sand stays behind to keep those fractures open.
So we know that different drillers use different hydraulic fluids, but what kind of chemicals are used? I've heard things like kerosene and other kinds of things like that that just don't sound like something we should be pumping underground.
Well, the original hydraulic fracturing treatments that were performed in Kansas and Oklahoma actually used gasoline and napalm. So companies have been injecting potentially hazardous chemicals underground for a long time. And some of the chemicals that are included now can also be toxic if encountered at large quantities. The concern is that some of these chemicals that are injected deep underground might find a way to migrating towards the surface and getting into people's drinking water. However, we've really seen very little evidence of that around the country, even though hydraulic fracturing has been deployed for decades. There are other risks that come with the process, but chemicals from hydraulic fracturing, there's really only one or two cases in the United States where we have good evidence that those chemicals have actually negatively affected groundwater supplies.
And when that happened, was that it leaking up through bedrock, or was that at the source of the wellhead where there's more opportunity for that stuff to escape?
Typically, the risks that you have associated with fracking chemicals occur at the surface. So when people are handling those chemicals at the surface, mixing it into the water, mixing it in with that fluid that we're talking about, some of it can be spilled either at the well pad or maybe from a truck that is transporting it from a well site to somewhere else.
So that's the other thing. What happens to this fracking fluid? Does it stay under there? Do you pump it back out? What do you do with it if it's got toxic chemicals in it?
Well, this depends based on where you are in the country and what type of rock formation you're injecting into. But a large proportion, you know, maybe at least 20% of the fluid that you originally inject comes back up to the surface. And even more important than the fracking fluid that comes up to the surface is the water that's actually found naturally deep underground with oil and gas deposits. All oil and gas wells, whether or not they're hydraulically fractured, produce a lot of water. That water is naturally high in metals, it's high in salts, and it's the sort of thing you can't just put into a typical water treatment plant. And so what companies do, both with the water from fracking and also with this naturally occurring produced water, is they have to manage it. There are a couple different ways to do that. One, and the most common way to manage this wastewater is actually by injecting it deep underground into what are called wastewater disposal wells.
Or deep injection wells. So you take it out of one hole and you put it in another hole and forget about it. That's basically what we're talking about.
That's basically what we're talking about. And the EPA, along with state governments, have actually been regulating these injection wells for decades. Most of them have operated without major problems. There are a couple cases that are out there where these injection wells themselves have led to pollution incidences of groundwater as well as spills at the surface. So they're not free of risks themselves.
Let's back up just a little bit. We've all seen the movies where someone just drills down, the oil spurts out of the ground through the derrick. So why is fracking even necessary?
If you imagine a movie like There Will Be Blood or a movie like Giants, where you see these enormous volumes of oil shooting up from underground, all of that oil is being produced by natural pressure deep underground. So the types of rocks that companies are drilling down into, they're not drilling into like reservoirs or pools of oil. All of this oil is and gas is contained within different rock formations. But some rock formations are spongier than others. Water and liquids can move more easily through some rock formations than others. In the old days, those big spurting wells were drilled into formations where oil flowed very freely. Those are called permeable rocks. The oil can move easily through them like a sponge. But the types of rocks that companies are drilling into now are much less permeable. Oil and gas flow much less easily through them. And so what companies need to do to unlock that oil and gas from those impermeable rock formations is create this artificial network of fractures, which is where hydraulic fracturing comes in. Those fractures allow the oil and gas to actually have pathways to move through that impermeable rock.
There was a film, a documentary that was released a few years ago, and in it, and I think a lot of people have seen this film or at least a clip of the video from it, when someone holds a flame to a faucet and it catches fire, there's methane in the water, and they blame that on fracking. First of all, was fracking the cause of that? Second, does that happen naturally?
This is a complicated question, and I want to answer it in two parts. So first, the first part is methane can get into groundwater because of improper cementing and casing of oil and gas wells. So if you drill a natural gas well, methane is coming up through that well. Methane is essentially the same thing as natural gas. If there are defects or cracks in the pipes of that well or in the cement that surrounds those pipes, then the methane can escape from the well and get into groundwater. There are over 300 cases in Pennsylvania alone where this has happened, and it's well documented. So in some cases, methane migration, or sometimes people call it stray gas, can negatively affect water supplies and cause that water to be flammable. Now, the second part of the answer is, as you suggest, this can also happen naturally. So there are many parts of the country where groundwater naturally has a high concentration of methane in it. So just because someone lights their water on fire doesn't mean that oil and gas or fracking were involved. It can actually come from both natural and man-made sources.
So you said more than 300 cases in Pennsylvania. I mean, it sounds like it's not uncommon to happen.
It's not uncommon. There are hundreds of articles in petroleum engineering journals about how you deal with this problem and how you try to prevent it by correctly drilling, casing, and cementing your well. But like any human endeavor, there are errors. And when I say 300 issues in Pennsylvania, let me put that in context. So in 2010 in Pennsylvania, a little bit fewer than 1% of the new shale wells drilled had some problem associated with methane migration or stray gas. So a little bit less than 1% of these wells were causing these types of problems. As time has gone on and Pennsylvania has updated their regulations, companies have gotten better at doing this type of activity. In 2015, the most recent available year, there were 800 new shale wells drilled and actually zero new cases of this type of contamination.
And when you say regulations, you mean basically the pipe and the casing that you're talking about that goes underground. They just updated to a better set of regulations on how those are built.
That's right. There's a whole chapter in my book about how oil and gas development and fracking is regulated. Many people have the perception that fracking is unregulated, and that's because there are very few regulations of the activity by the federal government. But state governments have a variety of regulations that they apply to the oil and gas industry, including what types of steel they need to use, what types of cement they need to use, and a variety of other regulations.
So we've been moving to natural gas. Natural gas prices have gone down a lot. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But one of the benefits the natural gas industry notes is switching a power plant from coal, burning coal, to burning gas means a substantial reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. What do we know about that?
This is, a complex issue. It's true that as natural gas production has surged over the last 10 years or so, the natural gas prices have gone down, and that's led to natural gas displacing coal in the electric power sector. Largely because of that displacement, U.S. carbon dioxide emissions are today down to their early 1990s levels. And that's a serious win in the fight against climate change. But there are other issues that we need to take into account. One of them is the concern that methane, which, as you remember, is the main component of natural gas, is by itself a powerful greenhouse gas.
And if it's leaking out to get in your water, it's leaking out into the atmosphere as well in some cases.
That's right. And there are over 2 million miles of natural gas pipelines in the United States. There are tens or hundreds of thousands of oil and gas wells around the United States. Any of those locations could be places where methane leaks. And so methane leaks have been a major interest for researchers, including myself, over the last 5 years or so. And people have been trying to get a handle on how much methane is actually leaking, and does it negate the benefits that we get from displacing coal in the electric power sector. And to basically summarize that research very simply, there are a few studies that find in specific locations, methane emissions are very high. If those locations were representative of the entire United States, we'd have a serious problem on our hands. But when you survey the full breadth of the research on methane emissions, what my analysis suggests is that the amount of methane escaping from the natural gas system is not enough to negate the climate benefits of switching from coal towards natural gas.
But it still reduces that 50% figure we've been talking about, that there are 50% less emissions going from coal to natural gas. It sounds like that's not as rosy as we've been led to believe. A fair number of environmentalists say fracking is merely prolonging our reliance on fossil fuels. They don't think switching from coal to gas is how we should be investing in our energy future. They want renewable energy, electricity storage solutions, more efficient buildings and appliances and transportation. How is fracking affecting our energy future?
Again, this is a tricky question, and it's an extremely important one when we think about the challenge of climate change. There have been a number of studies that look at the effects of natural gas, not just on displacing coal, but also competing with renewables, competing with nuclear power, and other energy technologies that can help us transition towards a lower carbon economy. And what many of those studies find is that if you compare a hypothetical world where the shale revolution never happened with a hypothetical world where the shale revolution did happen, that's more like our real world, and you project out 20 or 30 years into the future using economic modeling tools and atmospheric modeling tools, those two futures actually don't look that different because many of the benefits that we get from displacing coal in the electric power sector are partly offset by the competition of natural gas with renewables and with nuclear, as well as the fact that low natural gas prices and low oil prices encourage people to use more energy. And when people use more energy, emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases goes up.
I was going to ask you about that because natural gas and gasoline are both lower than they were before the advent of hydraulic fracturing. So
that's right.
Is it helping the U.S. economy or is it not helping the U.S. economy?
It is helping the U.S. economy. I think there's very clear research that both on the local scales where oil and gas development is occurring and also at the national scale because of these lower prices that we are all paying both at the pump and also in our utility bills through using natural gas as well as electricity, most American households have saved more than $1,000 each in energy costs because of the shale revolution. When you look at the local scale, and I've visited many oil and gas producing regions in the last 4 or 5 years, if you go to a place like Western North Dakota or West Texas or Central Oklahoma or, you know, many of the hundreds of communities where oil and gas production is an important part of the local economy, these communities have experienced major benefits from the shale revolution, but they are also dealing with volatility and challenges of being heavily reliant on an industry that's reliant on volatile oil and gas prices.
Boomtowns.
That's right. There are a number of places in North Dakota that I visited where, you know, the population 10 years ago was 10,000 people, and today the population is 25,000 people. And there are a variety of challenges that go along with that, expanding roads, expanding water infrastructure. Some of these places have seen increased rates of crime, increased drug use. So there are benefits and drawbacks to living in these communities.
Let's look at the big picture. It's said that fracking has made the U.S. more energy independent. We don't have to rely on foreign oil, for example. How true is that?
Well, it's certainly true that U.S. oil imports have gone down substantially. The U.S. is now exporting about 2 million barrels of crude oil each day. That's more than we've ever exported before. But the idea of energy independence, to me, is actually kind of the wrong one to think about. Any economy, including the United States, that uses a large amount of oil can never be independent of the global oil market. That's because oil prices are set on a global basis. If there's a war tomorrow in Saudi Arabia, oil prices are going to go through the roof. That will negatively affect the United States, or at least the drivers and energy consumers of the United States, regardless of how much oil the U.S. is importing or exporting.
So what I hear is we're still reliant on a good dose of Middle Eastern oil.
We're reliant on a global market in which Middle Eastern oil and other oil is important. The only way to be independent of a product is to not use that product.
The book is The Fracking Debate, The Risks, Benefits, and Uncertainties of the Shale Revolution. The author is Daniel Ramey. He's a senior research associate at Resources for the Future, and he teaches energy policy at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Chemicals commonly known as PFAS are being found at more and more sites across Michigan. If you live near one of these contaminated sites, you probably have questions and we want to hear them. Call us at 734-764-7840. Give us your name, where you live, how long you've been aware of PFAS contamination near you, and then give us your question. We'll try to get answers for as many as we can at 734-764-7840. Or you can send us your questions by going to the stateside page at michiganradio.org.
And a note before we go, the show today featured some interviews that aired previously on Stateside. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.